بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Bismillah al-Rahman al-Rahim. Hello, everyone. It's Qmars. And in Rokeya's absence, as she continues to report from the Northern Front in South Lebanon, it continues to be my esteemed pleasure to welcome you to Delete Your Account in close Axis of Resistance style collaboration with the Colony Archive and the Adnan Hussein Show with Adnan Hussein, Associate Professor of History at Queen's University in Ontario and Medievalist Scholar of Religion in Europe and West Asia, joining us for the first time and accompanied by Navid Zarinal. Lastly, but certainly not leastly, he's a historian of religion and Iranian modernity. And we are forming like Voltron to pick his brain and hear what he and other Iranians around him in Tehran are thinking and feeling and doing right now. So welcome to the both of you.
It's great to be with you and to meet you, Qmars, and to be seeing Navid again.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for having this conversation with me. And I look forward to your questions and analysis.
Yeah, you know, fair warning, I might be a little loopy today. I'm the only one of us, I think, who like just biologically, temperamentally should not be awake right now. But such is my commitment to, you know, truth, justice, and the anti-American way. And somebody has to counter-program all the nonsense that you're hearing right now from basically everyone else. But yeah, my brain is below 20% charge, so I'm on low power mode right now.
We need an enrichment program to get you up to like 80 or 90%. I got to weaponize that intellect.
I have to assert my sovereignty. I'm lucky actually that I don't have to assert my sovereignty that much today, because if Sina had been able to join us, you were really going to have to do a lot of work, Adnan, to help me rein him in, because last time I had like serious questions that I wrote for Navid. And I'm not saying I'm blameless in this, but we didn't get to like half of them. But Navid, I really want to start just by highlighting again some of your recent work and ask you how you're doing, what you're thinking about personally before we talk about, you know, other people's stories and also geopolitical events. You just visited internally displaced families in Tehran who lost their homes due to the U.S.-Israeli bombing. They're being hosted rather in 4-star hotels, the furthest thing from being held, with entertainment and food. And you visited them and documented some of their stories. What struck you the most?
Yeah, so no, I think we've been watching the Western media so much that we have these Freudian slips. It's not a Freudian slip, but rather we kind of take their vocabulary.
No, that's a Freudian slip. I'm a scholar of Freud, and that's a Freudian slip.
Yeah, okay, I got you. No, I mean, it's funny because I saw actually my friend Shahzadeh tweet this, that they're already referring to prisoners of war that Hezbollah or Iran might be taking as hostages. So it's funny, the kind of double standards and the special nomenclature they use and apply to Iran. But going to your question, it was a very inspiring experience because I went there with some other friends who were filmmakers, and we were working on footage and content about what has happened to these people. So basically, everybody who was there had lost their home due to the U.S. and Israeli bombing. I posted a picture of an elderly woman who was a widow. Her husband has passed away. And she lived near the leader's office. So on the morning of February 28th, when they bombed the leader's office. She lived in the same neighborhood, and so her house was badly damaged. And her account was that a young man came to rescue her. So I don't think her building fell, but it became so damaged that it was no longer habitable. But there were other people there whose houses were probably entirely, you know, destroyed. Because, you know, I've been to the sites, and there are two kinds of destruction we see. One is that, you know, the entire building is flattened, that there's nothing left, you know, minus rubble and bricks and such. But there's the other scenario where the structure is still standing, but then the windows are blown out, the doors are shattered, you know, the personal properties are mostly destroyed. And I think she fell in the latter category. But then there were families whose houses were entirely destroyed. And so they were being housed by Tehran's municipality, by the mayoral office, and the entire thing was being paid for. And I think the mayor's office was getting the money from the foundation of the dispossessed, or Bunyad Mustaz'afin, because they're one of these public state foundations here that have a lot of money. And I think they were providing the funding for it. And then what was also amazing is that they had breakfast, lunch, dinner paid for. So, you know, they would go to the hotel and eat. And I even had dinner there because, you know, they were also hosting us as journalists and filmmakers and content creators. And, you know, they also gave us, you know, a hamburger that was pretty decent quality, Iranian hamburger, but it was pretty good. And tea also, they were giving us fresh, you know, Persian tea. So, I mean, the whole thing was amazing that, you know, because, I mean, I was thinking that, you know, well, you house them, but they're responsible for their own food. But even every meal was also being provided. And I think the idea is also that the Tehran's municipality will pay for the reconstruction of their homes. It might have a lot of bureaucratic hurdles that they have to go through, but I think the idea is that they will pay for a reconstruction of the home. And I even spoke to a cafe near my home. It's only about a 100-meter walk from my home. And the lady there, her windows were blown out because they targeted a Revolutionary Guard garrison very close to my home. And the windows of that cafe broke. And it had actually, after the windows broke, it had a really cute European-style kind of setting where, you know, you could, there was no window and you were kind of like, you know, you had access to the street. But then she was telling
how
me that
romantic.
It was romantic. You know, the war made it romantic. But she was telling me that the mayoral office will pay for the windows, again, for the glass to be installed. And she told me that if the glass breaks a second time because of a new round of bombing, then the mayoral office will pay for half of the second reinstallation of glass. So the state is doing all these kind of socialist things in order to help people and keep the spirit high, and they're using the state funds to pay for it. And yeah, and so the families were there, and they had, you know, it was such a good atmosphere too, because they had entertainment. So there was a clown that came that played for the children. There were young women from the families, and they were playing piano and violin, and, you know, people were like, you know, attending and kind of celebrating. And there were also, that was interesting. The other interesting point was that there was a cultural element too. There were these clerics or mullahs that were also there that were providing kind of cultural programming for the families that were there. So it was very well planned, well organized. And I think it's great that they're doing this in a difficult time for the Iranian people.
Yeah, Adnan, anything you would jump in with? There was a lot there. And I, you know, thank you for doing this work, Navid. It's so important.
Yeah, I mean, your dispatch videos on the ground from Tehran have been really valuable, I think, in informing people about local conditions and giving a different perspective. And you've covered some very important topics in addition to the treatment of displaced people due to U.S.-Israeli bombardment. I noticed that you recently did a kind of interesting sort of account about, you know, we're all academics or, you know, people in the so-called knowledge industry. And you had one thing that I liked is that you went and you visited this University of Science and Technology that had been bombed and attacked. And in addition to surveying, you know, the damage done there, you had an interesting way of framing the sovereignty of knowledge and knowledge production to contextualize why this was so important and what was at stake in these attacks. I'm wondering if maybe you could tell us a little bit more about why you think Israel and the U.S. are targeting facilities like this that are civilian, educational, research, and how that fits into the politics of knowledge and what it really means to be a sovereign nation in this time.
Yeah, no, great question. So, I mean, I actually try to frame it historically and say, if you look at colonial history that both you, Adnan, and Qumars are familiar with, in the 19th century, what the colonialists, the European colonialists, tried to do is that they tried to either marginalize or even fully erase. You know, I don't use the term erase lightly, because in the kind of the post-structuralist academia, people say everything is being erased. But in this context, I think, you know, if you look at the indigenous knowledges in the Americas or Australia, those were really erased in some fundamental sense. But when it comes to the Sharia and, you know, Islamic knowledge, that was more marginalized. It wasn't fully erased. I mean, you still have the madaris that are functional in the Muslim world, and they have kind of preserved and transformed and perpetuated the Islamic knowledge. So you have all that. But what colonialism did is that through the missionaries, through the schools they instituted, through violence, through, say, the restructuring of the Islamic endowments in the Muslim context, they really marginalized the pre-colonial knowledges and ways of knowing and educational systems that existed. And so what Iran did is that Iran actually restricted the missionary activity very much. They were not able, so part of the mullahs, you know, the Shia ulama, part of their power was that they were able to restrict missionary activities in Iran during the 19th century, and the missionaries could only teach the non-Muslim children. But then, because of the modernization movement and because of the shock of colonial modernity, what Iranians had to do is that they had to modernize their education system, and they had to come up with new technical knowledges to build new things, new industries, new weapons that could withstand the British and the Russian threats in the 19th century. And so what happened after modernization is that Iran also developed a kind of a European-inspired and modern educational system. And then after the revolution, instead of trying to rely on foreign expertise, which was the case in the Pahlavi period, even though during the Pahlavi period, Reza Shah and his son were also attempting to, in a way, minimize the dependence on foreign expertise, but it was something that, you know, would take time. And then after the Islamic Revolution in 1979, we've kind of developed that indigenous element much further. So even the Karaj Bridge, that was the biggest bridge in the Middle East, that was about to be inaugurated soon, that was bombed by US and Israel, that was a fully indigenous bridge that Iranians, because back in the Pahlavi period, they would bring foreign engineers to build, you know, bridges and the more complex things in many cases. But in this case, this was a fully indigenous bridge. But the reason that they bombed the Iran University of Science and Technology, and I went to the site, and they bombed a STEM research institute and the physics building across of it. And the Islamic studies department were also damaged, but then the research institute was fully destroyed, as you can probably see on my Instagram photo, if you go to my Instagram. And so the reason that they bombed it was because in that research institute and in that university, they were teaching and developing the STEM fields in a way that contributed to Iran's sovereign defense, because Iran's missile program, the advanced missile program that has, you know, great GPSs, and it can evade all these very expensive American and Israeli interceptors, that is being developed indigenously fully in Iran. So they first assassinated a professor, professor of electrical engineering at Iran University of Science and Technology, alongside his two children. And then they bombed the very research institute that helped support Iran's missile program and Iran's sovereign defense. So you go from, so in a sense, in the 19th century, what they're doing is that they are erasing or marginalizing pre-colonial knowledge in order to rule more effectively. But now that they don't care that much about, you know, say the Sharia, they're more worried about a strong state that, you know, defends itself and that is independent from the imperialist-led system, then what they do is that they come. So they don't even use, you know, the kind of old school violence or the missionaries. They just use straight up bombs now to, you know, destroy your university so you're not able to develop that sovereign knowledge to defend yourself. And this is what happened with the Iran University of Science and Technology.
Yeah, I just want to make a brief note. You mentioned the limits of sovereignty and development under the Pahlavi dynasty. And I saw this on Twitter the other day, and I'm sorry, I don't remember who posted it. We probably follow some of the same people, Adnan, so you might know. But somebody posted a story that I hadn't seen before, where in Karaj, there was an attempt during the reign of Mohammad Reza Shah, the son, to build a steel factory in Karaj. And apparently they tried a couple of times to get funding from the World Bank, and they were denied. And the factory ended up being built, but only because the Soviet Union stepped in and offered to fund the project. And that's kind of a weird alignment for that period of time. You know, the Cold War was 100%, I mean, not maybe not as much by that time, but it, you know, the tensions very much put Iran and the Soviet Union at odds. And yet it was still the Soviet Union that was willing to see an Iran that was able to, you know, produce its own steel. And the supposed sponsors of this puppet government actually required a very short leash for their patronage. And they didn't see Iran being able to make its own stuff, even as a vassal state, to be acceptable, or I guess, you know, what a vassal state is supposed to do. You're just supposed to, you know, sit there and buy our stuff while we, you know, export your raw materials.
Yeah, that's an interesting point about the history of development, that even the vassal state, and that of course is very similar to the story of Iran's nuclear energy and civilian nuclear program, is that it was under so much restriction, even though this was a period when the Shah of Iran was basically a pillar of U.S. imperial policy in West Asia, you know, like maybe even the more important pillar than even Israel at that time in the 1960s and early 70s. It's only after 1967 that the U.S. started itself investing directly very much in supporting Israel. And certainly, of course, after the Islamic Revolution, everything changed and they had to depend solely on Israel. So, you know, Iran was supposed to be this great ally. And what are the benefits of being an ally of U.S. empire if they don't allow you to develop your own economy, continue to make you totally dependent on their science, technology, knowledge for development? Imperialism is the real imperialism works. But this point about the steel industry, I think, is also interesting because there's been recently news coming out about Israel and the U.S. targeting steel production and steel factories, I believe, in Khuzestan, in Ahvaz, the Khuzestan Steel Company, and Mubaraka Steel Company in Isfahan province. And I saw something that, you know, was quoting some boast by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that they had destroyed 70% of Iran's steel production. And it shows that the goal, whether it's true or not, and of course, how do they know? Because, you know, there's a lot of production that's been moved, you know, to secret locations or underground, etc. So, you know, one doesn't want to believe anything that one of the world's great liars in history, you know, is saying. But what it does is that you know, they are trying to deindustrialize Iran. This isn't just about so-called regime change. You know, it is really the civilian infrastructure, bombing the universities, bombing industry, and so on, is to really try and set Iran back. And so I'm wondering if, you know, you have any sense of that, Navid, and also how people, how people's consciousness, because you've done a lot of like interviews with people and commented also on the phenomenon of, you know, many people returning to Iran, you know, in order to stand in solidarity with their people, with their country, with how people's kind of impression of what the West, you know, is, or the U.S. Is, you know, might be changing when they see the level of destruction and targeting, not regime people, so-called regime people alone, but actually the whole society.
That's right. So I would say that even on the first day of the bombing, or, you know, right before the war, some Iranians had this perception that U.S., especially U.S., less so Israel, but because, you know, U.S. is a superpower, and because of that, it kind of has a special status in the consciousness
also,
of many people.
Also, they just think Americans are super cool, and it's completely unjustified, and there's no way to talk them out of it. But it's just, a fact that Americans will always have a special place in the hearts of Iranians.
Yeah.
Hopefully, forever, but...
No, I mean, at least they did before the war, but I would say now things are a bit different. And again, most of the things I say are anecdotal because, you know, I don't have clear data, but the question is whether the data is even reliable, because the polling that you see coming from a lot of these Western-based NGOs about Iran are totally bogus. So I think the anecdotal thing might actually be more useful right now. But yeah, I mean, I would say that they had that perception, and they were saying that, our missiles are not that accurate because, you know, we made it ourselves, and, you know, we're not like the Americans that are, you know, the leader in technology and in progress and so on. But the American missiles or fighter jets, when they come, they hit the exact point. But then after a few days, they were like, holy crap, we were wrong. And, you know, they're just hitting. I mean, even if they're targeting a military or a security site or something, say, infrastructure like a steel factory, what happens is that in the process, things that are around it also get destroyed and civilians get killed or cultural sites are impacted. I give you one really interesting example from yesterday. So I was just walking near a friend's home on a relatively crowded street in Tehran. And then they had struck an office building for whatever reason, for whatever, you know, strategic value they thought it had. And there was right next to it a building that was a medical center and a pharmacy, and that was also badly damaged. So I think they had used either a smaller missile or a smaller bomb. So the medical center was still standing, but it was so damaged that it was, you know, not operating anymore. So that's one example of how, you know, even if there's, you know, targeting the military sites and the strategic sites or the factories, you know, things around that get damaged and civilians also get killed. So I would say that definitely the perception of the Americans has changed, and people, Iranians, have also realized that they're not interested in making a deal or in peace, and that they really only understand the language of force, because, you know, they've seen Habibbo. And I mean, it's just like it's
someone should tell Javad Zarif that, but we don't have to get into it.
I was hoping we would at some point get into it, but let's let Navid tell us what he's doing, and let's come back to that Zarif question.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't read the Zarif piece yet, partly because I think you need a subscription to Foreign Affairs or whatever, you know, magazine he wrote for, one of these, you know, Western legacy medias. But I heard bad things about it, so I'm trying to avoid it. And I like Zarif, you know, he's a nice diplomat, but I think he's just a little bit naive about, you know, the West, and about American imperialism. But just to wrap up, so we can have more, we can have your analysis too. But basically, the perceptions of the Iranians have changed, and they're realizing that the way the Americans and the Israelis are conducting their operation. It's about degrading Iran's industrial base at Nonset, and even to turn Iran into a failed state. And one last thing I say is the other thing is that in the Western media, I mean, they might say that, oh, if you're a Qazan that's starving, you know, we might care about you, you know, or if you're a civilian, we might care about you. But I think we have to step back and also question the very narrative that it's okay to even bomb the military or the security or the strategic sites. I mean, you know, who gave the U.S. and Israel the right to preemptively attack, you know, all these military people in Iran, you know, the Revolutionary Guard, the officials, you know, just because they're affiliated with the state, it doesn't mean that it's justified to kill them in this kind of illegal and unprovoked way. So I think the entire war is unjustified and unprovoked, and that needs to be emphasized, even though the killing of the civilians is extra repugnant.
Yeah, I mean,
thank you so much for that.
Yeah, go ahead, Adnan.
Oh, no, just like maybe to come to that point, you know, that we Kumars, you introduced, you know, because I'm kind of interested in, you know, how political culture might be developing in Iran under these circumstances of the war. And you've been mentioning, you know, the change in perception of the United States and the West, and that has led to this very determined, defiant attitude expressed by at least a very substantial segment of Iran's population that has been coming out nightly for rallies and chants and just expressing and showing their solidarity with one another and with their government. That is, I think, one of the greatest resources that Iran has for its defense, is this sense of public will, connection, commitment that makes any attempt to try, which is why they've gone to just destroying a lot of infrastructure and killing a lot of civilians to try and, you know, degrade the capabilities and capacities of the society, because any other political goals have clearly been a failure with the reaction of Iran's people. But yet we have this kind of, you know, very important ex-official foreign minister, current, you know, professor of politics at Iran, writing an article advising, you know, that Iran should make a deal now or soon, and of course, you know, on good and beneficial terms, but that it shouldn't try and perpetuate the war for minimalist kinds of gains on the ground, but actually take a negotiated solution. This will be better, he says, for Iran. But he publishes this not in Ittilaat, in an opinion piece there, or on some program. You know, he publishes it in English, in Foreign Affairs Journal, which is an organ of the Council on Foreign Relations. This is like the utter center of the U.S. imperial foreign policy establishment. What is the purpose of such a thing? And also, since you're there in Iran, what is the reaction that people have had to this kind of overture? I mean, one could argue that perhaps this is a ploy and a way to sort of establish through indirect means kind of suggestion that, you know, there could be some negotiation and then actually end the war, and that this is, it's an attempt to posted about it, at least an initial reaction that...
Adnan, buddy, you're cutting out a little bit. Could just rewind like a sentence or two?
Yeah, just that, you know, it's there are different ways of interpreting what the significance of this is, and if it is even a strategy of Iran. I mean, I'm not convinced by that, but I know that Ali Alizadeh on Jadal, you know, characterized at least in his initial reaction to this publication, that this might open up a false impression for the imperialists that there are fissures or differences, and that there are, you know, kind of people within the Iranian kind of government or political establishment who would be open, and that this will encourage a new attempted wave of assassination of leaders and attempt to do that, because, you know, Trump has been talking about that he's supposedly, I mean, is it total fantasy, or is this exactly the kind of thing that he has been mentioning when he says that, you know, he's in dialogue or discussion with elements in the government that are worth, as they will actually accept a deal. Well, and then you have Zarif publishing this. I mean, it seems like a really concerning move. So I'm wondering what you think about it and what people are talking about there about this.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, thus far, I've only received my friends' reactions, and most of them are not too happy with what is written. I haven't read it myself, so I can't really judge for myself yet. But yeah, most people that I know personally are not too happy with it. Other than that, I mean, the IRIB, Channel 6, which is the news channel, they haven't really talked about it, and their position is that, so the kind of the announcements or the declarations that they put out is that Iran has not negotiated with the Trump administration in any way after the war, and what Trump is claiming is false, and he might be doing it to impact the markets that are, you know, suffering major instability because of the closing of the Strait of Hormuz, or the effective closing of the Strait of Hormuz to hostile ships and cargoes. But regarding the second part of your question of whether, you know, this has some sort of policy impact, what Zarif has written, it's a good and difficult question, because I don't even sometimes know who's really making the decisions here. Because, I mean, the easy answer is that it's the supreme leader. So formerly Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and now his son Mujtaba Khamenei, and they make the decision, or they make a major recommendation, and then the Revolutionary Guard kind of carries out the policy in accordance with that recommendation. But then you also have, you know, the president and the foreign ministry, and they also have a lot of power in foreign policy, even if the ultimate recommendation or decision comes from the supreme leader. So it could be that they kind of have a logic of their own, and they do certain things that the supreme leader doesn't approve of. So there are these kind of tensions within the system, as opposed to, say, the U.S., where it's a little bit simpler. I mean, say the U.S. president has advisors, and then those advisors say, you know, advise the president, and the president, you know, makes a decision. It's kind of clear that he is the commander in chief. I don't know how Canada works with the prime minister, whose name I'm forgetting. And also, he was so cringe because he condemned Iran's unprovoked attack on the UAE. And I'm like, buddy, what are you talking about? Just yesterday, you gave some anti-colonialist speech that the Western countries have not abided by their own international rules.
Our third worldist prime minister of Canada, Mark Carney.
Yeah, so I don't know how Canada works, but in the U.S., you know, it's kind of clear. You got that commander-in-chief who's the president, but Iran is a little bit more complex. And also, Iran's system is a more kind of personal system. Relationships matter. A lot of things are oral. A lot of things happens based on these kind of political networks that are in the system. So you don't have everything, you know, documented, and you don't have everything. It's not like the U.S. where you have just these kind of clear documentations about everything, where you kind of follow, you know, how the decisions were made. But no, even the U.S., I'm kind of overstating it, because you have all these things that are classified and secret, and you have the Epstein regime. So, you know, it's not really that kind of, you know, trackable and documented either. But yes, I mean, I would say that the reformist position, or the so-called, what the Western media calls a moderate position, is out there, that they just want to negotiate and kind of, you know, do a semi-surrender with the negotiations, and they don't want to fight. But at the moment, it seems that the policy that they're executing is the so-called hardline policy, which is the anti-imperialist policy that, you know, we will fight because there's no trust in you for negotiations, and we will fight until Iran comes out in a stronger position than before.
So just to follow up, and also for folks that also haven't read or heard about the contents of that foreign affairs article by the former foreign minister under President Hassan Rouhani, Javad Zarif, the author of that piece, the main point that I've seen repeated also in US media besides that initial outlet are sort of a mutual non-aggression pact of a permanent nature, reopening the Strait of Hormuz to, you know, any and all takers and genocidaires, and also, you know, just general kind of, you know, shipping all of the uranium out of the country and some of the other, you could call them concessions. And it does sort of seem to add up to surrender, especially given Iran's strategic advantage at this point. But Trump does keep talking about, in his most recent address, which is sort of his only real substantial, I think, address to the American people. By substantial, in America, we mean more than 3 minutes long these days. But it was about 20 minutes. And he keeps talking about working with a new and more reasonable regime. This is kind of their like joke that they're, this is like a bit for them where they're just like, yeah, well, technically it's regime change because there's new guys in the regime. It changed. And you're just like, shut up, you fucking Nazi beefheads. But also the possibility remains that Trump isn't completely bullshitting. Like maybe they are talking to people who aren't speaking on behalf of the regime right now, but could be, I hate using this example because I don't know what's actually going on in Venezuela, but like somebody who could be like a Delcy Rodriguez figure, truly no disrespect to her. Like, I don't want to litigate that right now. I just mean like a top insider, maybe that doesn't describe Zarif anymore really, but somebody that they can embrace under this banner of more reasonable. It certainly sounds ludicrous now when the IRGC, by all accounts, is sort of making the big decisions and calling the big shots, to call them more reasonable or moderate from the US perspective. But who do you think he could be talking about? Could it be somebody like Zarif? Would he dare like coordinate in some sort of secrecy? And would he even be able to, or would anybody in a position to do so be able to without attracting the attention of you know, others in the Iranian security establishment?
Yeah, I mean, I doubt it. You know, I mean, Zarif is not even in the state, right, in the government right now. No, so I doubt it. I think it has to be coordinated at some level with the different elements. So for now, I think it's just kind of a think piece, but it does reflect a major sentiment within the Iranian state establishment.
That's important. Let me also call attention to some other aspects of this that I would be curious to get your thoughts on. I have like a whole a tranche of Trump quotes also from that address. I don't know how much of it has been reported on or what the analysis is in Iran. I would be interested to hear. But he added just a couple of points. He said that they killed 45,000 of their own people, referring to the regime, which kind of indicates to me that the war is going so badly that they decided they had to add another 15,000 to this fake death count. But it just seems like, given we've talked about this before, they sort of helped create the pretext for this by pushing this number of over 30,000 people killed and the government was behind it all and there was no terrorism, the terrorists of the regime or whatever. And a lot of it was really comical, but this was like blood libel on like a sliding scale, because every time they inflate the numbers, it makes it sort of relatively more acceptable if thousands and thousands and maybe hundreds of thousands of Iranians end up dying in whatever unfolds. There was a lot of focus on the timeline, like focusing on the timeline at this point feels pointless to me, but he did say that the war would be ending, quote, very shortly, within 2 to 3 weeks, during which famously, as Hegseth also repeated, we're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages where they belong. And he starts listing the durations. This is the funny part. He starts go ahead.
He meant the Achaemenid, the Achaemenid Empire.
Yeah, the Hachovanishia.
Which is not too, it's terrible, yeah.
No, people posted this map. It would expand Iran by like a factor of 3 or 4, I think. They controlled a lot of territory back then. But he starts listing the durations of all these other U.S. wars. This is another like indication of how poorly it's going and how unable they are to convince anyone in America. I mean, I guess they don't have to convince anyone in America to let them keep doing it. Americans seem just fine with this level of bloodshed. But he's like, oh yeah, it took us, we were in Korea for this long and whatever. And, you know, in historical perspective, basically to paraphrase Dave Chappelle, how long is 32 days really? And like, he even implied that they might withdraw without opening up the strait, which, it's just bizarre. He said the strait will, quote, naturally open up. Because Iran has to sell its oil. And as you already noted, Navid, the strait is actually perfectly open for anybody who wants to buy Iranian oil or even just be nice, right? So how much of this is even making news in Iran at this point? Do people care what Trump says? Does it seem at all realistic to you? That this could come to an end within the time frame he indicated? And what are people thinking about that in Iran?
Honestly, I'm not going to take anything Trump says and does as a way to analyze or predict the future because it's just so erratic and ridiculous. So I think I would look more to the circumstantial evidence and other things that are happening or the circumstantial evidence around Trump's, you know, declarations and tweets and whatever. Because it's just unprecedented, I would say, in my lifetime to have a leader like this at such a high level. And back in, say, 2016, is that that's when he became president. So in 2016... I remember I made fun of the liberals for being like, oh, this guy is so dangerous and blah, blah. And I was just saying he's like the rest of them. But now I stand corrected that honestly, it's better to have someone like Obama or Biden in office than someone like Trump. Because, I mean, if I was an American who cared about, say, my country's longevity and interests as, say, a superpower, then I think it's better to have someone like Obama in power than someone like Trump. But anyway, sorry, I said this point so many times on your podcast that
no, you're just doing a bit at this point. Like, I love Obama, like ironically.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, half ironically, but I do miss him at some level. Also,
I voted for Kamala Hitler. We've all made this calculation.
See, Adnan has it easy because he can only vote in the Canadian elections. So
actually, I can vote in the U.S. I am a U.S. citizen.
Oh, crap.
So, yeah, I get the benefit of participating in a totally useless and meaningless choice between, these two parties. But yeah.
You got to the core of what I meant when I asked this question, certainly, that people, so you would say that people also in Iran are not paying close attention to
not really. They kind of joke about it and the news kind of like puts it on as kind of a joke, but they don't take it seriously. I would say it doesn't have a major impact on the policies here.
I think the Lego videos and anime production that have been so thrilling to the world as part of Iran's counterinsurgency or insurgency in the Psy War have really made that point that people may hear about it, but they kind of lampoon and pillory and mock, with a good, interesting political point. So those have been just amazing, like the one that talks about the foundations of U.S. empire and all of the victims, both from the settler colonial experience in North America to global South victims of U.S. imperialist war, you know, in like less than 2 minutes. Like the whole thing is put together in this kind of vivid, humorous, engaging, but politically useful way. And so I think that's one thing that I think is interesting and, you know, worth thinking about a little bit more is how Iran has advanced very much in its diplomatic information war messaging, you know, kind of going around mainstream media because it knows the U.S. mainstream media is not going to, you know, report on conditions in Iran or articulate Iran's message fairly or accurately, no matter what the statements of its officials might be and so on. They will take small clips and twist it and all of that. And so this is a way of going directly to global public opinion to get a kind of different counter view. But I found it interesting that President Masoud Pezeshkian actually just a few days ago made a direct appeal to American public. And that was a kind of interesting letter. You know, I'm wondering how that is. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it, but he makes some interesting arguments there that seem to suggest that he understand something about the internal political situation in the United States. And have found a few kind of key arguments to make political points that might be effective to an American audience.
Yes, I mean, with that Pezeshkian letter, I mean, I think he's playing the Tucker Carlson game that, you know, it's really Israel, not America, and you should not be fighting this war on behalf of Israel, even though it is also really an American war, and Israel, in a way, is an American base in the West Asian region. But I think both Tucker and Pezeshkian have a good point prescriptively. So, I mean, I would say descriptively since, you know, 1967, as Adnan mentioned, there has been a kind of a divergence of, you know, elite interests between Israel and the U.S. and in terms of the convergence of the political policies. But it doesn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to be this way. And I think prescriptively, the U.S. should move away from Israel because, you know, in the long term, it would also put American interests in jeopardy. So if you're someone like Tucker Carlson, who's interested in your country staying a superpower, then it doesn't really make sense to be supporting Israel no more in the way that they're supporting Israel. So prescriptively, I think, you know, U.S. should move away from Israel. And I think Pezeshkian understands this and kind of he was playing that PR game when he wrote that letter. And Adnan, you're right that I think the Iranians have gotten better at PR over the years. I mean, one point that I often think about is that they don't really need to be good at PR because I'll give you one kind of anecdotal example. So I went to the Melita Museum, I think it's called Melita in Lebanon. It's a Hezbollah museum where they kind of have, you know, even some of the Israeli tanks that were captured when Hezbollah expelled the Israeli forces from South Lebanon. And in there, you know, there's this photo of all these Israeli soldiers that are kind of, you know, running away, and a couple of them were black. And, you know, I was telling a friend there jokingly that, you know, if they were good at PR, they would not put a black soldier there to kind of show, to not say that, you know, the Israeli army is diverse. But then, you know, she told me that it doesn't matter because, you know, this is for kind of, this is not for the globe. This is, you know, for the Lebanese. And there's no reason for them to be, you know, attuned to the political sensitivities of, you know, the Canadians or the Americans or, you know, the EDI stuff that, you know, the Americans or the Canadians are interested in for PR. Not EDI, it's DEI, diversity. Since DEI is kind of going out of fashion in academia, I forgot the acronym for it, but diversity, equity, inclusion. So there's no reason for Hezbollah to care about that or kind of do that in their PR. In the same way, my position is that should the Iranians even care about the American sensibilities? And I think at some level they should, because Iran is a big country, you know, it's going to engage with the world now. So at some level they should, but I don't think, you know, they should put their entire messaging in a way that would be appealable, say, to the Americans. But in certain small areas, especially in the diplomatic arena, I think they should. And I think Pezeshkian, the foreign minister, Araghchi, et cetera, they're doing that right now. And they've gotten better at it, including with the Lego movies that they're releasing. But they also have to be careful not to alienate their own supporters here who might not really be interested, or the whole, you know, American political sensitivities might not be comprehensible to them. So I think they should play the double game in kind of fighting the PR war. And I think they've been doing it more effectively this time around.
Here's what I would say. I love that you put this in terms of descriptive and prescriptively correct, because I have heard the argument from people that I respect that we should strategically play into the possibly sometimes anti-Semitic, I would say kind of very, very much so on the right, anti-Semitically inflected, like Zog adjacent conspiracies about how Israel is actually in control of the US government. And I think that this converges also somewhat with the narrative of like material interests also not aligning. I think that this is true to an extent, but we have to acknowledge that like Israel exists and has been supported by the US. And I've heard others make this point that we have to acknowledge that Israel has a function as a sort of a militarized attack dog, creating dissent, scaring the shit out of everybody, putting a gun to everyone's head in West Asia as a sort of outpost of colonialism, of Western white capital. And it's precisely through the exercise of sort of extreme unreconstructed violence through Israel that the US has maintained such a strong foothold in that region over the years. And we see now how globally significant US control over West Asia is in terms of our relative position here as the global hegemon. And in many ways, our absolute position. And if you're talking about like the petrodollar, for example, and all of this is now being threatened, and seemingly these trends towards US decline are being exacerbated, but it's, you know, this is dialectics, right? Like, it's not like if they had stayed, you know, in a more restrained posture, the contradiction of China rising, multipolarity, the US losing its imperial reach would have just gone away. I don't think that this is the sort of thing where we can say there is no US interest in making sure that there is no sovereign Iran. I think that there very much is a US interest in preventing a sovereign Iran. And what people like Tucker are probably comfortable with is the idea of this, you know, this paleocon, like we're just another white country. We have no obligation to take in immigrants, but also we have no obligation to control everything. I even question the extent to which Tucker himself would be comfortable with the extent of global American decline. I think it's very likely that he wouldn't. I remember him clapping after the Venezuela operation in the White House along with Trump.
I saw that.
Yeah, and so I would say that it's entirely possible that this descriptive truth is still necessary to assert that like we're going to end up barking up the wrong tree or being very, painfully disappointed, that we will eventually, I think, seem naive for thinking that we could use anti-Semitism or sort of American conservative nationalism against empire. I think the people that are so ideologically, paleocon or nationalist or isolationist, whatever you have, whatever you want to put it, are so few ultimately. Just like so many people on the left are probably not as anti-imperialist as they think they are once you start talking about the quality of life that we've been enjoying for the last, you know, eight or nine decades, going away. So I wonder what you think about that, just as a, this isn't necessarily like a, ear to the ground, what are Iranians thinking question, although I wonder if there's a discourse about this. But I do think that at the end of the day, like there's not this easy dichotomy ever between being right and winning, like that you can't win without being at least a little bit right. And being super wrong in this case, just feels like just another manifestation, maybe even of that Iranian. Back to the Pezeshkian letter, that Iranian naivete about how you can actually appeal to Americans.
Well, I say one thing quickly, and that is especially because delete your account audience, you know, they're interested in kind of the inner left issues of the U.S. Is that if the U.S. loses its status as a superpower, I mean, you mentioned that, you know, the quality of life that Americans have enjoyed for the past seven decades might go away. But in some ways, I could also even see the reverse of that, because, you know, if it loses status as a superpower and it starts investing in its own people as opposed to these foreign wars, maybe people will have, you know, a better education, better healthcare. I mean, they might lose certain things, you know, such as, you know, the power of their passport might decline a little bit. Or that, you know, there might not be these extravagant, you know, just like amazing skyscrapers in every city, but, you know, they might have better healthcare and education. I think the vast majority of people prefer to have better healthcare than seeing a skyscraper or a fancy mall in a big city.
Yeah, that actually leads into, I want to be respectful of your time, so please bluntly let us know if you have to go. But
I got another 20 minutes.
Okay, very good.
15, 20 minutes.
Since you brought up skyscrapers and, fancy malls, I do want to talk about the regional. We often talk about the regional relationships with Hezbollah, with Ansar Allah, with the Axis of Resistance. But I want to focus a little bit also on the regional relationship with the U.S. vassal states, the GCC countries that have been getting pounded. Obviously, as time has gone on, people have seen various, you know, data pertaining to this. The U.S. bases obviously have been largely destroyed, and strikes on the Arab countries in the Gulf have decreased, and strikes on Israel have increased in ferocity and destructive power. But it was very important, and this is a phrase that came out of the early messaging from the Islamic Republic officials after the war began, that they want to kill the idea of Dubai. And for me, that is such a powerful statement. It was an early indication that something very different is happening than what we're used to. Because I realized this is actually so universal. Like, as somebody who's like of West Asian background and grew up here, there is a Dubai in my head. I even say Dubai, right? Dubai, or that's probably, well, we say, you know, we say it the Persian way. So who says that's right either? But like, there is a Dubai in my head. Kill the Dubai in your head was what I heard when I heard this messaging from Iranian officials. And it feels so important that these countries are now being truly forced to choose between a regional a security framework that includes Iran and excludes US and Israeli interests, or this permanent antagonism dividing the region. I've heard mixed things really from people who know better than me about those countries about whether this will ultimately push some of the countries in the GCC or in the region away from collaborating with the US and Israel, because they've seen that actually all the US needs them for is protecting Israel and making money. Or will they kind of say, well, fuck this. Like, this seems to be the more mainstream, certainly Western narrative, that like the assumption is that, well, how would the Gulf Arab countries ever forgive Iran for attacking the bases there and also damaging, obviously, things that are part of that the country as well? It's not, it's not like literally only bases have been hit. But I do think that that's an open question that I hesitate to be dogmatic about. Will the extreme, effective, and necessary retaliation against the Gulf Arab states by Iran ultimately work in favor of regional unity or against it?
Yeah. So I'll say something quickly because Adnan has been quiet for some time, and then I'll turn it to him. But basically, exactly what you said, I'm not dogmatic about it either. And I think the tankies are a little bit too optimistic right now that somehow, you know, after the war, the GCC will just, you know, kick out all the American bases and, you know, will turn towards multipolarity and all that. But my position is that it's difficult to predict, but I would say that if it happens, it would be a gradual process. So it's not something that would happen overnight, but rather, I mean, we even saw it before the war that, you know, the Saudis and the Pakistanis made a defense pact, because I think the Saudis realized that, you know, they cannot put all their eggs in the American or the NATO basket. But I think it is something that will happen over time, but not immediately after the war, unless there are popular revolutions in places like Bahrain and Saudi Arabia. And in Saudi Arabia, I would say because they're not hungry, it's pretty unlikely that they would have a popular revolution.
Well, that was a very excellent economical kind of summing up of, I think, an important point. I mean, I'm hopeful that it might be more region changing, you know, inshallah, if the war continues and they are forced to choose, you know, more seriously. But until that happens, yes, I think they will be clinging to other options. As you said, Bahrain, Saudi are the, you know, places where there's more potential in some ways, because there is a large Shia population in Bahrain that I recall seeing some videos that the initial strikes on the U.S. radar installations at the, you know, base there for the Fifth Fleet, you know, being very celebratory. And we've seen that there have been demonstrations. So, you know, there are potentially big changes. But I actually had been wanting to ask you about Pakistan, and you referenced this mutual defense pact between Saudi and Pakistan that you know, is interesting. And you put out a very fascinating video about Pakistan's relationship to Iran, the long historical and cultural Persianate kind of influences, you could say, for a millennia, the fact that they have a long border. Pakistan has been very helpful about Iran's sovereignty being needed to be respected, but yet at the same time, because it is not a normal sovereign state either, its military class is totally in the thrall of like having a good, positive relationship with the United States. And they've been also reinforcing certain aspects of Saudi's potential resistance against some kind of integration into a regional framework with Iran by providing some possible nuclear umbrella and so forth, is that it's in this real double position. And we often talk about the West Asia side, but we don't think about what's happening to the east of Iran and how much that might, you know, make a difference. I'm wondering if you have any further thoughts and analysis since your interesting video, or at least some of the key points from that, about how to think about Iran's relationship to Pakistan, Afghanistan, India in this broader, you know, is that a kind of key that we might be missing? I was on a panel recently in Philadelphia on the situation in Iran, and one of the panelists was a South Asian anthropologist, so we had a chance to think about it. But when I was I thought, oh, it would be really great if Navid could be on it, because he knows Pakistan and he's been talking a little bit about it. So what do you, you know, what do you think about that relationship and the direction things might take as a result?
Although one qualification, and that is I know Pakistan more through my heart than through my intellect. So I'm not, you know, an expert per se. But I mean, yeah, the way I see it is that it's similar with, you know, say, I mentioned the possibility of a popular revolution in Bahrain. And you also mentioned the Shia element. I think that helps in because, you know, Iran does kind of have the affinity and the alliances with the Shias of the West Asian region. But in Pakistan, I mean, about, I think, 20 or 25% of the population is Shia. But that's not the only element. Even the Sunnis, I mean, I was seeing some, you know, poll, and the Pakistan was probably the single nation that had that showed the most support to Iran during the current war. Even the Sunnis in Pakistan, I mean, I recently appeared also on Amanullah Tarif's Ian podcast, the English version, because he also has an Urdu version. And I think some of the feedback was a bit negative, because there is still that kind of, you know, the Iran is a Shia country that we might not trust, and you kind of maybe have that in some Sunni countries. But overall, I would say, you know, the Sunnis and the Shias of Pakistan support Iran. But I think that the political and the military elites, they're kind of in a conundrum, because on the one hand, they kind of want to get closer to Iran, but then they're scared of the U.S. reaction, whether it's in terms of sanction or cutting off the military cooperation and, you know, whatever else that they might be benefiting from, or some of the economic cooperation, perhaps. So I think they are in a conundrum, the Pakistanis. But I think, you know, if the popular sentiment is more respected through figures like Imran Khan, who was sidelined, then, you know, you would have more support. And the more support you have, I mean, even in Afghanistan, too, I think Iran and Taliban have a decent relationship right now. It's not the best relationship, but it's a decent relationship. And that could also develop. And India, you know, they've gone in the Israeli direction, unfortunately. So there's not much hope there as of, you know, the immediate future. But I think with Pakistan and Afghanistan, there's a lot of possibility for regional cooperation that would weaken American and Israeli power in the West and South Asian region. But unfortunately, it's not something that will happen overnight. But I could get into my kind of tanky persona and say that will happen tomorrow, the liberation. So maybe
well, that will inshallah, be. But you know, we do also have to pay realities on the ground. But I mean, I think just on the Modi on India, you know, it's kind of a funny thing, because you're right, preceding the start of the war, during the buildup, you know, Narendra Modi, Prime Minister of India, went and, you know, humiliated himself by, you know, being, you know, really supportive of Israel, and, you know, a massive nation like, you know, India, to take up this kind of position. It was, you know, somewhat demeaning, I would say, to the dignity of India, and people may have felt that. But, you know, once the war started and the Strait of Hormuz was closed to certain, you know, hostile countries, suddenly he started tweeting an awful lot in Farsi. He learned Farsi overnight, you know, and was trying to communicate a different perspective, you know, because so much of their energy comes directly from the Gulf. So, you know, I think we will, changes won't be completely final and dramatic in the short term, but I think there are some longer term trends. You're right, Navid, to say we can see that there could be real South Asia because of the Ramadan war and Iran's position. So fascinating stuff. We will watch and see.
We can watch and see and make nuanced observations, or we can just keep talking about the China brokered Iran Saudi, you know, whatever that was. I think that did a lot of that was doing a lot of work for a while in my optimism that we were all kind of going to come together a little bit more as a region, or, you know, West Asia, kind of de-escalating a little bit from the U.S. imposed divisions. But yeah, it remains to be seen.
Kumaris, it's obvious that that was considered a threat in the way that it gave you optimism and me and people in the region that, oh, there might be some regional policy here. That's clearly also what alarmed the United States and Israel. This war is, in some ways, of course, it's about, you know, continuation of, like, the, you know, greater hegemony, or, you know, the possible hegemony of a greater. But it's precisely because, you know, they have to thwart other possible alliances and arrangements that might bring peace and prosperity to the region outside of the direct U.S. system. That's why we had all this buildup and war. In some ways, you could say it's a response. So one hopes that if Iran is successful in its resistance, that there might be opening up a more permanent possibility for those kinds of cooperation and regional arrangements to go forward.
Yeah, no, that's a very encouraging thought. Navid, why don't you share any final thoughts of your own, and we'll let you go. You're muted still.
So, I mean, my final thought is just kind of continuing the last thing that Adnan said, that if Iran, I mean, Iran, I think, is winning at the moment, but I mean, we don't know what will happen in the future. But say, you know, the war ends and Iran comes out victorious, then I think the regional and the neighboring countries will also gain some confidence to actually create a new world and also really make the shift towards multipolarity and also the weakening of Zionism and Israeli apartheid in the region. So that's the hope. And even the Iranians, the last thing I say is that even the Iranians, because after 47 years of resistance, you know, they were upset that, you know, all I'm left with is, you know, inflation and a crappy car manufacturing business because the cars are Iranian made here and they're not great. And so this was their perception. This is all I'm left with. But now that Iran is winning this war, or at least it appears that it's winning at the moment, they have more confidence now. And they kind of see that the kind of the price they've paid for the resistance has paid off in a way. Because even the U Chicago professor, I think his name is Robert Pape, if I'm not mistaken, he even had an analysis today. And he's a very kind of, you know, pro-empire, pro-America, not even America firster. He's kind of, you know, the traditional liberal pro-America guy. And he was saying that, you know, now there are four centers of power in the world. So it used to be Russia, China, and the U.S. But now with what has happened with this war, Iran has become this fourth center of power. So that this has given confidence to the Iranians, if it's true. And I hope that it would also give confidence to the region as a whole in combating imperialism and moving us towards a more multipolar world order.
Amen, inshallah. Honestly, I want to thank you so much, and I look forward to our next conversation. I think this is a great thing we have going here, and I want to make sure everybody also knows where to find you both, actually, especially those listening. I would recommend that they run, not walk, to YouTube to subscribe for the Colony Archive and the Adnan Hussein Show. Follow the amazing work that Navid is doing reporting in Iran, and Adnan hosts some of the most wonderful and illuminating and deep conversations.
But the main work right now is on my personal Instagram. The tag is, so because that's where the Adnan saw my post. The tag is the Colony Archive, but it's where I'm posting most of the stuff on Instagram now, because TikTok is Zionist run now. So I have fled to Instagram, even though it's Zucker, but at least Mark Zuckerberg has that kind of nice Obama, you know, personality to him. Instagram is where you can see some of the updates about the war.
Okay.
And of course, the Adnan Hussein Show and yours. Mm-hmm.
That's right. And let me just finish saying about Adnan's show. It is absolutely one of the places where you get the most, I think, illuminating Marxist-Leninist, tanky, but also very much Muslim and, as you would put it, politically Shi'i perspectives that I think is exactly the configuration that, I don't know if it all works together. I'm still trying to work that out for myself, but this very much feels like where I want to be. I want to thank you guys here for being with me, and we'll catch you next time.
Thank you, Kumars, for hosting and letting me join you in discussing with Navid. And it's great to see Navid again. We wish you safety and we will continue following your work. And, you know, may Allah protect you and the Iranian people, inshallah.
Thank you.
Very good. See you later, haters.